Welcome to the Human and Technology Podcast. This podcast is for anyone who develops, distributes, or uses technology. For all those who always have the feeling that technology overwhelms or dominates them. For everyone who wants to know how to deal with technology in everyday life. For anyone who wants to understand what technology does to us and how we can get our lives back. This podcast is for those who want to make technology sexy. All the product developers, designers, UX, UI professionals, product managers, CTOs, and CEOs. And it is for you. My name is Dr. Peter Ryska. My friends call me Dr. Peter. I am your host, and I am happy that you are here. Science creates knowledge. In this episode of the Human Technology Podcast, I will have a closer look on the relationship between science, technology, and HMI, human-machine interface developments. So, the relationship between humans and technology is defined in the area of two science and the tension created by two scientific disciplines. And a little spoiler up front, one of these scientific disciplines has to do with humans and the other with technology. This is why I discuss science in general. I will have a look on the history of science. I will have a look on the role of science today. And the role of science in the creation of technology and HMIs. And this is where the focus of this episode lies. Science plays a major role in the media discussion these days, whether it's about climate change, whether it's about the pandemic. But it's also relevant for the creation of HMIs for analyzing and designing the relationship between humans and technology. I will start with an excursion into the past, then a few points about the role of science today, and the third part of the podcast will be on the analysis of sciences that are relevant for designing the relationship between humans and technology. A few sentences about the history. The mainstream opinion is that science started when humans gave up the nomadic lifestyle, started building communities, and picked up the sedentary lifestyle. This, in part, mostly is true. I would not see it that strict. So I think that even nomadic societies had the chance to collect and sort knowledge to pass it on. But the big scientific progress, was created by non-nomadic societies. It started in the early days with the observation of sun, moon, and the stars, for example, to forecast the best time for seeding, maybe also for harvesting, but also to identify the optimal days for religious festivals, religious days, religious procedures. One example of very early science that we know is Stonehenge in England. We have the artifacts, the stone artifact left only. We do not really know what they did at this time, why they built this monument. And I mean, it must have been an enormous effort for the society at that time to build this granite monument. And I had a discussion lately with a friend of mine, and he said, the stone thing, the artifact, that survived. That's what we still have today. And we don't know the idea. We don't know why they had this. But since the orientation of the monument uses the longest and shortest day of the year, it must have been something that is somehow connected to seasons, to the changes of the movements of the sun in the sky. So, as I said, we don't really know it, but there is a high chance that it has to do something with the measurements of sun, or it represents the movements of the sun. So that must have been something like this. Another example is the Mayan calendar that was created for exactly that reason, seeding, finding out the seeding, optimal times for seeding, and the best times for religious festivals, religious procedures. So that was also a very elaborated piece of science, very early in history, that lasted until, I think it was the 21st of December 2012. So 21st of December 2012, I think, was the day when the Mayan calendar ended. So we don't know why it ended there. Probably the guy that created it was just ready for dinner that evening. I don't know. I have no idea. But so those are Stonehenge and the Mayan calendar, two examples of early pieces that are connected to science. A big step forward was the introduction of number systems, of figures, of calculation rules. The first ones doing so were the Babylonians. They used a system of numbers, of figures, of calculation that has the base of 60. 60. That was because there are many whole number divisors in 60. And we still have this today because we have 60 seconds in a minute and 60 minutes per hour. So we had this, we still have the 60s division in one of the daily used number systems. The decimal number system, as we know it today, with 10 as a basis, was first introduced in India. Another step was the introduction of phonetic transcriptions with about 30 characters by the Phoenicians. Since almost any alphabet that is based on phonetic transcriptions has between 25 and 30, 35 characters, it seems like the number of different sounds that we can create while speaking must so around 25 to 30 characters must be enough to describe this. I mean, in Germany we have a little more than 30. The basics of the Latin characters is 26, and so 30 by the Phoenicians. I just had an analysis about the Arabic alphabet for a client, and there they use 28 characters. So this number of 25 to 30 seems to be sufficient to write down what we speak. The ancient Egyptians were not that good in mathematics, numbers, figures. At least they did not leave anything on this. But they had a very high level of knowledge on medicine. We still know this from the mummies that survived. They still exist. We can see it. We learn a lot about the Egyptian cultures from the mummies, but they knew exactly how to prepare human bodies, and we know that they also had a deep knowledge about medical contexts. They built the pyramids. Nobody really knows how they did this, and that there is, opposed to what I said earlier, a lot of mathematics in there. We don't know how they did this, and but the Egyptians also had science on a very high level long before our modern times. Let's make a big jump ahead in time. For me, one of the core turning points in science, technology, and HMI design was the invention of book printing by a guy called Johann Gutenberg in Germany. And so that is for Europe. It was in the mid-15th century. I learned lately that in China, they started earlier with book printing. Not really lots earlier, but slightly earlier. But for the development of science in Europe, the invention of book printing by Gutenberg was a big turning point. Knowledge became available much easier than before. And that was the basis of the revolution of sciences in the Renaissance. And the creation of new ideas in the Renaissance was the basis of the science as we know it today. One example was Leonardo da Vinci from northern Italy. He started around 1500, and he did inventions like the helicopter. He analyzed the human body. So he also painted the Mona Lisa. So he was a universal genius. And so that was typical for that time. And with all his calculations and his ideas and the putting down of the ideas that he had, he was the founder, one of the founders of today's science. At that time, there was a strong conflict between empiristic collection of new knowledge and the tradition. There was a strong discussion, what has more value, the tradition or the new knowledge? That changed 200 years later, starting in 1700. There was the Enlightenment. And at that time, there was a separation of religion and natural science. And what they called rational thinking was invented, or became the focus, or gained more importance. So God, as a driving force, lost importance. And a high acceptance of new knowledge, of the new, was existing. So reason, being rational, was the universal judging authority. Until then, originally, there were only three disciplines in science: theology, law, and medicine. Today, we are having a close to infinite number of disciplines. So if you look at how many different sciences you can study at a university, that's a huge number. And not every study you can pick up is in science by its own, but the raw number of sciences is far beyond the three ones we had originally: theology, law, and medicine. This leads me to the next point. There is no such thing as the science. There are many different sciences. And even within a single scientific disciplines, there are different schools, different directions, different interpretations of knowledge, and very often different personalities with different views that have their own ideas, opinions, theses, hypotheses, own ways of research. So there is not the one science. Science in itself is neutral. So science is not good or bad. Science is not, it's neutral. What you do is you build, and this is the traditional, very well established, almost fully accepted way of doing science. You build a hypothesis, and that is based on existing knowledge. So you read a lot about your area of science, maybe of other areas of sciences, and then you build a hypothesis. Very often an if-then kind of sentence, if I do this, then that will happen. And then you will start analyzing that. You will maybe do experiments. You will collect empirical data. And then you get the chance to run a falsification. It is impossible in science to say this is true. All you can say is this is wrong according to the data. And as long as something is not proven wrong, you can take it for correct. This is the falsification according to a German philosopher called Popper, who invented that one in the early 20th century. And scientific theories are buildings of hypotheses. So if you collect hypotheses that circle around a common issue, a common problem, a common phenomenon, then you can build a theory out of these hypotheses. And then, again, you can have the chance to prove it wrong. And as long as it is not proven wrong, we can take it as correct. We can not believe in it. Well, that's everybody's right to do this. But from a scientific point of view, you have to set up hypothesis based on scientific knowledge that already exists, and then start the empirical part, build a theory, and then you get the chance to prove it wrong. Science is one of the big drivers of progress. There is no technology without science. So our highly technological world, the world we live in, is based on scientific findings, on analysis, we are standing on the shoulders of giants if we develop, if we handle materials. So there's always a scientific background in any of these areas. And again, technology in itself, like science, is neutral. So we, as humans, with what we do with technology, we create good or bad technology. We make it a good or a bad use. But in itself, first of all, it is neutral. I see the relationship between humans and technology from the perspective of two sciences. One is psychology, and the other one is engineering. And those of you knowing me know that I studied mechanical engineering. I picked that up at university. And I then started later on to better understand the relationship between humans and technology. I picked up psychology. And I made my PhD in engineering with a very psychological thesis that I wrote. But there are many reasons why I believe that engineering and psychology drive the relationship between humans and technology. And that is the reason why I said, okay, I'm going to study both of this and mix the knowledge to create the best possible solutions that we can find. For me, psychology has always been the science of healthy people. and not the science of healing. So when I picked up psychology, there were many people that were very much into psychoanalysis, into healing people, into bringing people back on track. And I found this somewhat pretty strange, because if you go to the roots of the problem, meaning the world we're living in, and the world we're living in is highly driven by technology, and if I design technology in a way that it is humanized, that people can use it better, I do not create the problems that psychology or many psychologists try to heal. So, yeah, as I said, psychology for me was always the science of healthy people, and I will get a little deeper into this in a few minutes. Engineering, opposed to that, was always for me the science of the useful, not of the feasible or the possible. My feeling is that very often engineering is trying to find out what is possible, what is the most advanced technology I can create, what is the most advanced solution that I can bring to life. And so engineering became the science of the possible. For me, it was always just like, if there is no use behind a technology, why should I create it? Why should I develop it? So for me, it is engineering is the science of the useful, by creating technology that supports us as human to make this world a better place. So let's have a look at the role of psychology in technology design. It is the cognition processes, first of all, that where psychology can give us a lot of knowledge for the creation of HMIs, for designing the relationship between humans and technology. So cognition is a core process, a core human process we should have a look at. So we have a very, very early filtering and assessment of information in our peripheral or very early stages of neuronal information processing. Just a little anecdote about how this information processing, this unconscious and early information processing works. I took a walk with my wife, and we walked here in the area where we live, and my wife works in real estate and I work in automotive, and we were walking side by side, and we stood there and we looked around, and I thought, what an ugly green. And my wife said, what an ugly green. And then I said, yes, this Seattle Leon is totally ugly painted in green. And she said, no, those balcony covers, they have a totally ugly green. And so we saw almost exactly the same scene. We were standing side by side, and there was an ugly green car in front of an ugly green balcony cover. And she, as in a real estate lady, had a look at the balcony, and I, as a car guy, had a look at the car. And I didn't see the balcony, and my wife didn't see the car, although the information on our retinas had both. This shows how information processing, how this filtering on very early stages works. And this is part of psychology. It's about information intake, about cognition, it's about the amount of information we can take, it's about the type, the kind of information, it's the different channels, what kind of information can we get on the acoustic channel, what kind of information on the visual channel, how much information can we transfer on a haptic channel. So that is also part of psychology. It's the information processing, it is the reflection on experiences. How do decision-making processes work, and how can we support that by a certain way of presenting information, or how can we falsify the wrong our decision-making processes. One cognition, one example of cognition that I'm working a lot with is the phenomenon of situation awareness. Basically, the idea of what is happening at the moment. So who is where, who is doing what around me, what will happen next. It was created by aviation psychologists for pilots, but we can also use it in any other kind of complex environment where we need to find out, is this person, is this operator, this driver or pilot, or computer operator, is this person ready to make the right decision? Other phenomenons related to psychology are fatigue, are vigilance, is the attention control, emotions, user experiences, all kind of experiences with technology. All that is the role of psychology in technology design. And all this is about a healthy human. How does a healthy human work? The role of engineering is a completely different one. Engineering is doing the implementation, the realization, the creation of technology. And there are different disciplines in engineering: mechanical engineering, electronic engineering, software engineering. So there are different levels of that, and this creates the technology, creates the product. And it's about the development of solutions of hardware, software, mechanics, mechatronics, designs, graphics. All that is part of engineering. Also, the realization of products up to the manufacturing, the mass production of products, also that is part of the role that engineering plays in creation of technology. So my personal focus is always very much on the development, because in my lifetime I have always worked in the development of products, but I'm highly aware that without all these production engineers, it would be very, very hard to realize a product, to bring it to the market. It's impossible without production engineering and logistics and all this to create a product. And then the role of engineering is the improvement, the optimization of products, minimizing the footprint, the ecological footprint, the cognitive footprint that technology has. So this is basically the role of engineering in creating technology. The relationship between the two scientific disciplines, psychology and engineering. We have to know everything about humans in order to design technology, not vice versa. You will know this, I'm stating this, it's on my website, I'm writing a lot about this, I'm talking a lot about this. But this is my deepest belief, that if we want to design technology, we have to know everything about humans. Not the other way around, that you design a technology and then you design the human, which very often happens if you design a technology and then teach people how to use it and ban them. And so this basically shows the relationship psychology and engineering have when they work together in creation, in the creation of technology. In an ideal world, psychology explores, knows, finds out what is useful, what is needed, what is required, what needs and desires, dreams and wishes exist, and how we can fulfill them, what is really helpful to humans, and what can they master. And engineering is the enabler, is the implementer, is the improver, is the producer of all this to create technology. The reality is slightly different. Very often engineering is driving the process, writing specifications and then implementing that one. And at the end, somebody finds out, oh, we have a user experience department, or we have a user. We need to find someone that tells us a bit how we can improve it and make it user-friendly. This is what Alan Cooper called putting lipstick on pigs. Just creating some kind of technology and then trying to find out how to make it somehow usable. So in this case, psychology repairs, improves, and somehow makes it usable in a way. The relationship between psychology and engineering has changed significantly in the past, let's say 20, maybe 25 years, from the lead of technology to a fruitful, focused cooperation between the two disciplines. Today, there is a significant number of psychologists, especially in large companies, like, for example, the car manufacturers. And these psychologists working in these highly technology-driven environments, they take their messages and their role very seriously. They communicate a lot, and they realize their ideas in these organizations. In my personal experience, there is still a lot of leadership of technologists, of engineers, particularly if they come up and say, hey, this is not possible, or this is impossible to develop, or this is too expensive to develop. And that, at the end, still prevents user-oriented innovations and enforces technology-driven innovation. So, this brings us to an end. If you like this podcast, why not recommending it to one other person in your network? The more people listen to this podcast, the better it is ranked on the various platforms where I publish it. And that again will give more people the chance to listen to it, to get knowledge, to listen to my ideas, and to expand and change their views on the relationship between humans and technology. That's it for today. Thank you for spending time with me. I hope you were able to take something with you and do something for yourself that will be forever. For an ongoing exchange, you will find me on LinkedIn and on my websites, dieter-rösker.com and beyond-hmi.de. Write me an email on the podcast at beyond-hmi.de. Tune in next time, take care, and stay healthy.